All right, we were talking about shuttles when we left off, and we already covered the glycerol 3-phosphate shuttle. We were in the middle of the malate aspartate shuttle, and what are these shuttles good for? What are they all about? What is being shuttled? Not actually the NAD, no. That's the problem. The NAD would like to go into the mitochondrion and drop off its electrons to the electron transport chains, but NAD itself does not get through the inner mitochondrial membrane. That's why you need a shuttle. So what's really being shuttled is the energy in the form of the electrons and protons that came from the fuel that NADH is carrying out in the cytosol. That gets dropped off from that NAD onto something else, depending on the shuttle. And then it's once it's in the mitochondria, and then it can be delivered to the electron transport chain. So in the malate aspartate shuttle that we're looking at in slide 12, oxaloacetate picks up, oxaloacetate out in the cytosol, picks up electrons and protons from NADH that's out in the cytosol that's created from glycolysis, right? That's what's happening here in the upper left corner. The reception of those electrons and protons by oxaloacetate transforms that into malate. It's exactly the reverse reaction that happens in the citric acid cycle, right? At the end, when malate is transformed into oxaloacetate. Well, when malate turns into oxaloacetate, that was a dehydrogenation, right? This is the opposite. So the hydrogens are received by oxaloacetate to turn it into malate. That oxidizes the NADH back into NAD+, so it can go back to glycolysis and pick up more electrons from more fuel. But the malate now goes through one of the two antiporters that are part of this shuttle. The one on the left here is the malate alpha-ketoglutarate antiport. And remember, it's an antiport because it's moving two different things in opposite directions. Malate is going into the mitochondrion, or into the matrix specifically, because this is the inner membrane, at the same time that alpha-ketoglutarate is leaving. All right, now malate that is now inside the matrix is carrying the electrons and protons that were originally from glucose. They then get taken back off of the malate and put onto an NAD plus that's already in the matrix. That's going to reduce the NAD plus into NADH and H plus, right? And that's going to transform malate into oxaloacetate. In other words, it's exactly the reverse of the reaction that happened outside, just outside. It's reversed in here, and this is exactly the same reaction that occurs as part of the citric acid cycle in the matrix. So these two reactions, oxaloacetate to malate outside and malate to oxaloacetate inside, are catalyzed, not surprisingly, hopefully it's not surprising, by the same enzyme, just operating in reverse directions. What is that enzyme? Which you already know from the citric acid cycle. Malate dehydrogenase, exactly. Okay, so there's a cytosolic version that's working in reverse to transform oxaloacetate into malate. Then there's the matrix version that's working in the dehydrogenation direction, dehydrogenation of malate, that is, to form oxaloacetate. So the nice thing about this is that you start out with a cytosolic NADH, you end up with a matrix NADH. And therefore, you don't lose any energy in this process, right? Compared to the glycerol 3-phosphate shuttle that we lose a little bit of energy on because we start out with an NADH in the cytosol and we end up with an FADH2 in the matrix, which isn't able to dump its electrons off to the first member of the chain and therefore doesn't pump as many electrons and therefore doesn't end up representing as much oxidative phosphorylation potential as an NADH in the matrix does. Okay? So, for this thing to keep operating as a cycle, you need oxaloacetate outside to to continue picking up electrons and being transformed into malate, right? Well, the oxaloacetate is regenerated in the matrix, but the problem is oxaloacetate can't just go back through the membrane to the cytosol or the cytosolic face of this membrane and operate directly. Instead, oxaloacetate that's in the matrix gets transformed into aspartate, so that aspartate can then leave and get transformed once it's outside back into oxaloacetate. Now, really, this is just a shuffling around of an amino group. So this is a transamination reaction. And the reaction is catalyzed by something that's called aspartate transaminase. Okay? Glutamate and aspartate are amino acids, right? And they therefore have amino groups on them. Glutamate delivers an amino to oxaloacetate to make it into aspartate. That's happening inside the matrix. Aspartate then is able to exit the matrix through the other of the two antiports. This other one is the aspartate glutamate antiport. Okay? So aspartate gets exported back out into the cytosolic side, in other words, into the intermembrane space, where at the same time that glutamate comes in. All right. Once the aspartate is outside the matrix, then it does the reverse reaction. All right. Alpha-ketoglutarate will be transformed into oxaloacetate as aspartate gets transformed back into glutamate. So even though that oxaloacetate that's out there isn't really the same one that's in here, it has the same effect. It can complete the cycle. That oxaloacetate that is now ready to go for another round on the cytosolic face can receive hydrogens, electrons, and protons from NADH and continue this shuttle. All right, so you need four enzymes, but there's two copies of each of two enzymes. There's malate dehydrogenase, a cytosolic version and a matrix version. And there's aspartate transaminase, a cytosolic version and a matrix version. And the two versions of each of those work in reverse compared to each other. Okay, any questions on the shuttle? The nice thing, as you see on slide 13, and as I just said moments ago, is that with this shuttle, you maintain all the potential energy of the NADH that's out in the cytosol because you end up dumping its hydrogens onto an NAD instead of an FAD in the matrix. Therefore, that first complex receives them. Okay, now into 14. In the matrix, of course, is where the final parts of cellular respiration occur. Well, it's where cellular respiration occurs, and including those final parts, which is oxidative phosphorylation, and therefore ATP is produced in the matrix. But ATP is needed out in the cytosol. So ATP needs to leave, and ADP needs to come in. But just like a bunch of other things that we've talked about, these molecules don't readily go through the fairly impermeable inner mitochondrial membrane. So there's a transmembrane protein complex in the inner mitochondrial membrane. We just see one of them here, but there's many, many copies of it. This blue thing that is called ATP-ADP translocase, because it translocates these two particles. It swaps one for the other, In so doing, ADP is imported into the matrix in exchange for ATP, which is being exported. Now, ATP and ADP both have phosphoryl groups on them, right? And phosphoryl groups are charged. And this is a major reason why these things don't just readily go through the phospholipid bilayer, right? They're ions. So what is the driving force for this translocation? It looks like there's no energy being spent here because ADP is coming in step one up here on the upper right. The temporary binding of the ADP to this carrier protein causes a conformational change that exposes it to the matrix side. It pops off and that exposes a binding site for ATP in the matrix to bind to it. Another conformational change will flip it back to the original position and release the ATP to the exterior. Seems like there's no energy being used here. But there actually is energy being used here because what's driving this is the proton motive force that this is the theme of this whole chapter. What do I mean by the proton motive force? The gradient of what? Right, the gradient of protons that the electron transport chain itself produces and maintains. Now, we've already been talking extensively about the fact that that serves as a form of energy that allows for the oxidative phosphorylation of ADP into ATP, the ultimate payoff. But it can do other kinds of things as well. And another thing that it does, importantly, is to operate this ATP-ADP translocase. The reason it makes sense, hopefully, is that ATP has an additional phosphoryl and therefore is more negatively charged than ADP. Think about the direction of the gradient of protons, which are positively charged. Because of the direction of pumping from the matrix to the intermembrane space, the cytosolic or exterior surface of the inner mitochondrial membrane is comparatively positive, and the matrix surface, the inside surface, is comparatively negative, right? That makes sense? So, ATP, which is more negative than ADP, wants to go where it's more positive, which is the outside surface. And ADP, which is less negative, wants to go where it's less positive, which is the inside. And that's what really drives this thing to continue to work. Now, that's really important because you need a continuous supply of ADP. You have to have something to phosphorylate to make ATP. That's the ADP that's coming in. And the cytosol needs that ATP for all kinds of stuff that's exergonic happening out in the cytosol. But part of the energy that came from glucose and that is in the form of those protons that have been pumped goes into actually operating this. Because as this thing operates, as ATP goes out and ADP comes in, you are degrading some of the electrical part of that electrochemical proton gradient. Right? When you let a negative come in, when you let a negative go out in the form of ATP, you are undoing some of that positive that the protons are outside. So you're reducing the electrical component of that electrochemical gradient. And therefore, you're using some of that energy that was in glucose just to do this. This is one of the reasons why not all of that energy goes into making ATP. You know, another reason is that some of the electrons, if they use the glycerol 3-phosphate shuttle instead of the malate aspartate shuttle, are going to lose some energy as well that could have gone into more ATP production. And there are other things, as we'll see, that get pumped around as well because of this proton motive force. And as a matter of fact, we'll see that right now in slide 15. So the pink, this is just a sampling of many, many kinds of transport proteins that are in this inner mitochondrial membrane that one way or another rely on the proton motive force to move things through the membrane. This isn't a complete listing, but we've already talked about this one right here on the left. The magenta one here is this ATP-ADP translocase, and it works hand in hand with the one on the right here. This phosphate carrier needs to work hand in hand with the ATP-ADP translocase because it's not enough to give the matrix ADP. You also have to have phosphate to stick onto that ADP to make the ATP, which is then exported out of the matrix, right? So the phosphate comes in, notice, in exchange for hydroxyl. And when that hydroxyl that's coming out of the matrix meets up with protons that are also being pumped out of the matrix by the electron transport chain, you form water, right? Hydroxyl and hydrogen ions make water. Well, that degrades the gradient as well. So some of the energy is spent in that way as well. You know, you eliminate a hydrogen ion, you therefore eliminate part of the chemical component of the electrical chemical gradient that is the proton motive force. And similarly for other carriers that you see some of here and that there are others not even listed. Okay, 16. Well, a lot of textbooks will have a similar table to this where it shows you an accounting of the number of ATPs that are produced in the various steps along the way. I don't want you to memorize these numbers because, for one thing, they're not true. They're not always true. These are estimates. And the reason that they can only at best be estimates is because it really depends on the situation. It depends on what's happening. Like I said, it depends on what shuttle's being used, how much energy is being used just to pump things around rather than to phosphorylate ADP, and so on. But the big point, and I'm sure you already knew this, is that compared to just glycolysis, cellular respiration with its oxidative phosphorylation steps at the end ends up making a lot more ATP for that same amount of energy that was in that original glucose than it would if you just stopped at glycolysis and coupled that with fermentation. You would only make a net of 2 per glucose, not nearly as many. Okay, 17. This is a summary slide again, but the point of this is that we say that electron transport is coupled to chemiosmosis. But I started this chapter, I think it was the second slide in the chapter last time, telling you that the electron transport chain is not physically, mechanically coupled to ATP synthase, right? ATP synthase operates for chemiosmosis. The electron transport chain is not actually directly connected to that. Remember, we looked at the vesicle that didn't have electron transport chain in it. It just had ATP synthase, and it still worked as long as you shone light on the bacterial rhodopsin molecule to pump the hydrogen ions. But the two are actually still said to be linked, even though they're not mechanically linked, because one will not operate without the other one operating at the same time. So if either one shuts down, they both shut down. And this kind of explains why here. The two things at the top, which are embedded in this one membrane, this is all the same inner mitochondrial membrane, are exactly the things that we looked at in the last couple slides. The ATP-ADP translocase in the upper right, and the phosphate carrier on the upper left. Those are continuously bringing in fresh ADP and orthophosphate, or inorganic phosphate, as the raw materials for oxidative phosphorylation via ATP synthase. right? Well, we've already talked a lot about the fact that the ATP synthase molecule has to spin in order to do that phosphorylation of ADP, and it's not going to spin without the proton gradient, allowing protons to come back through. But it also is not going to spin unless there's ADP available, an inorganic phosphate, to bind to those subunits in the catalytic knob. All right? So even if you have plenty of electrons trying to trickle down through the electron transport chain, if you already have a high energy charge, effectively all of your adenosine nucleotides are in the ATP form, then you wouldn't have ADP coming in. And if you don't have ADP binding to this catalytic knob, then the thing is not going to turn, even though the hydrogens are wanting to diffuse through it. Okay? So that, just a lack or a paucity of ADP is going to shut down ATP synthase. And if that shuts down, then the pumps that are working in the electron transport chain will very soon stop pumping, because there's only so steep a gradient they can produce. Think of it by analogy with a water pump. You know, you can take an impeller pump, which is one that has a little water wheel in it that actually pushes the water uphill. Well, you can put a hose on the exterior of that pump, and it will pump a certain vertical distance. But you can't use that same pump to pump infinitely high, right? Eventually, the force of gravity pulling that water column back down is going to equal the force that the pump is trying to push it upward with. And no more water will be pumped. There's a limit, in other words, to the gradient that it can produce. Similarly, there's a limit to the gradient that these pumps in the electron transport chain can produce. So they're just not going to work. If you don't let the protons trickle back in, diffuse back through the ATP synthases, then eventually that gradient is going to be so steep that the pumps can't pump against it anymore. And so that's why without ADP, the shutting down of ATP synthase will shut down the electron transport chain as well, which is a good thing. That's really what you want to happen. You don't want either one of these things to operate if you already have plenty of ATP on hand. It would be just a waste of fuel. Okay? On the other hand, if you have fuel available and ADP is building up because you've been spending a lot of ATP, then you want both of them to operate because you want to use that fuel to make ATP molecules. Oh, and by the way, the blue part of this, the citric acid cycle, which is what CAC is, that's going to be shut down automatically if the electron transport chain shuts down. Because if the electron transport chain shuts down, it's no longer receiving electrons from NADH or FADH2. That's going to leave those coenzymes in the already reduced form. Well, it takes oxidized forms of them to receive more electrons from the citric acid cycle. So they're not going to be available. So it works very well, just automatically. All right, now 18 is a different thing here. Up to now, we've been talking about operation of the electron transport chain for the purpose of oxidative phosphorylation, because we want ATP. And that's definitely, by far, the major use of it. But in certain species, there are times in which the electron transport chain can become uncoupled from ATP synthases. Remember, I just explained that it's only a functional coupling anyway. It's not a mechanical coupling. The entire electron transport chain in this figure is just represented simply by this yellow tube. It's, of course, more complex than that. But that's what that represents. Oxygen's receiving electrons from the fuel to become water, and that's pumping protons. Normally, those protons would diffuse back through this pink ATP synthase molecule to phosphorylate ADP. But notice that's X'd out. Because that's not what whatever organism this is wants to happen. Instead, this organism is going to use the proton motive force for a different purpose. Specifically, thermogenesis, or creation of heat. And what this does is really just short circuit the whole mechanism. This green thing is an uncoupling protein. That's what UCP stands for. It's not always there. But if the, and not all, like I said, not all organisms are able to do this. But for whatever reason, this organism needs to heat up in a hurry. So what it does is embed these UCP proteins into the inner mitochondrial membrane. If they're not there, they don't do anything, of course. But if they're embedded into the membrane, they allow for protons to come back into the matrix through them. Now, the protons are going to go through any way they can get back into the matrix. They just want to diffuse down their gradient. So when you have a bunch of these uncoupling proteins in that inner mitochondrial membrane, the protons will come back through. And that's not going to produce any ATP for you. Instead, that energy really just amounts to heat being built up. Same way as short-circuiting a battery. That's why you shouldn't carry a battery in your pocket if you also have change in your pocket, right? Because you can short-circuit the battery and you can feel it get very hot very quickly. Because if you just allow the electrons to go right back to where their gradient wants them to, without actually doing some sort of mechanical work, it's just going to be very hot. And some animals are able to do this thermogenically by uncoupling their electron transport chains from the ATP synthase. We don't see this in adult humans, but we do see it in infants. They have a different kind of, they have a set in addition to the normal kind of adipose tissue that we have, which is just for storage of energy in the form of triacylglycerols. They have what is called brown fat or brown adipose tissue, BAT. That's tissue that allows for this uncoupling to occur. And so they can undergo what's called non-shivering thermogenesis. They don't have to shiver the way an adult does. If an adult is too cold, the way the adult produces heat is just uncoordinated muscular activity, which is what shivering is, and that produces friction and heat. They can do it just by burning energy to short-circuit this whole thing and produce energy that way, produce heat. 19 is the final slide of the chapter. And this just is a kind of a flowchart slide that shows you something I've already told you, that a proton motive force, or a proton gradient, is useful not just to make ATP, but it's useful for all kinds of things. For instance, plants use it to actively transport all kinds of things into the cells. You know, they actively pump protons out, and then by secondary active transport, they import things into the roots, for instance. You can run little motors in the form of flagella, for instance. Plants also use it for NADPH. Where does that happen? In what process? Photosynthesis, right. NADPH and ATP are both required for the Calvin cycle, which is where the sugars are actually manufactured in photosynthesis. Well, ATP is made in photosynthesis, much like it is in a mitochondrion, but at the same time, NADPH is produced also because of that proton motive force. So there's all kinds of things, heat production we talked about just in the previous slide, that a proton gradient can do for you. It's a form of energy. And that's the chapter.